From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, Senior Lecturer with the Graduate School of Education, here with Dan Schwartz, Dean of the Graduate School of Education at Stanford University.
Hello, Denise.
Hi, Dan.
So I think we should change format a little bit. I want to introduce our guest early because this morning we sent you to his immersive virtual reality lab. And this is where – this isn't like looking at a TV screen. This is where everything you see in your head is moving with you, and it's all computerized, and you're sort of underwater or you're in a forest cutting down a redwood tree. And so I kind of want to bring Jeremy in so that when you talk about your experience today, he'll be right there to help us understand this. So today we're meeting with Jeremy Balanson, who is a Stanford professor of communications, a world's expert in immersive virtual reality. He's written the book Infinite Reality, and soon he's going to have a new book called Experience on Demand. So Jeremy, say hi.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Good. Okay. Okay. So now I want to move to this. So in preparation for this show, I sent you to Jeremy's lab. And like all people who study virtual reality, there's a pit. They all have a pit. And there's a plank, and you walk across it. So I want you to describe this experience, if you would.
Okay. I need to back up a little bit and set the stage. People need to know a few things about me, okay? I am the person who does not ride roller coasters. I get completely sick at 3D movies to the point where I take the glasses off and then you get even sicker. And I get car sick. So when Dan says, oh, Denise, you don't know a lot about VR. Let's send you to this lab. Literally my family last night, they were like, Mom, you're going to throw up. Like, this is – you can't do this. You're going to say no because and then Dan told me about this pit and that I had other possibilities of like a nice coral reef or cutting down a forest. And so I said, okay, I'll be okay as long as I don't do the pit. So what happens? We go and Brooke Donald, who's the director of communications for the Graduate School of Education, comes with me for moral support. And she knows and I'm like really kind of nervous going in already. And they decide – because we were kind of – pressed for time to make me the first person, and they put things on my legs, like they put these two straps on my legs. They put this thing, it looks like a mask that covers your whole head, so it's sort of goggles with a ski cap kind of thing, and all of a sudden the people in the room are gone, but it still looks like I'm in the room. Okay, so there's just, I don't see any of the people, but I see the walls and everything. And then all of a sudden, I see this wooden plank on the floor, and I'm told to step on the plank. And I look at Brooke like, hello, this is going to be the pit, and I told you guys I'm not doing the pit, right? So I even know that there's going to be a pit and that this plank is – but nothing prepared me for what happened next. Okay, nothing. I'm on the plank, and literally the floor disappears. And I'm looking down and I see a really deep – okay, when you think a pit, I'm thinking like a little sand pit like the kids do at the beach. No, this is like a seriously deep square hole. And let me just say this. There are blood stains all over the hole. I'm not making that up. It looks like blood. It totally looks like blood all over the hole. And the guy says to me
– it's for the record. There's absolutely no blood. There's rust stains.
Okay. Okay. I'm thinking blood. This is where my head goes. I'm thinking blood.
Sorry. Just let me point out that when I first did this, there were bodies at the bottom of the pit.
Okay. See? So that's why I thought it was blood because you told me there were bodies. So I'm thinking there's
blood. Literally. No blood. Okay. Audience at home, I promise you do not build blood.
Okay. This is what's going through my head. Now, let me tell you this. I know this is virtual reality. I know that I'm safe. I know that everything's fine. But – I don't know because my body, my hands start to shake. My heart rate goes up and I freeze. The guy says to me, okay, take a few steps and walk across the plank. And I said, no way. There is no way I'm doing that. I was freaking out. And he said, you want to come out? And I said, yeah, I want to come out. And so, you know, then the floor comes back up and the plank goes away and you're back in the room. But he said to me, a third of the people will not walk that plank. You are not alone. And I will tell you, my heart rate stayed up for a really long time, and my hands were shaking for a really long time. It was a scary experience. It was scary.
So I, like you, I would not walk the plank. I couldn't do it. And so, Jeremy, I'm inside a video game, and I know this is fake, and I cannot get myself to walk across the plank. Why is this? I know there's no pit there.
So psychologists, we call this presence. Presence is the word for the front of your brain tells you it's not real, but the back of your brain, that part that's in charge of keeping you alive, it doesn't know that VR is not real. We'd like to say the brain has not yet evolved to differentiate a really realistic, perceptually vivid experience in VR from an actual experience. So the point of my lab's work, we build experiences and then we use these experiences to make you better, to make you learn, to make you rethink yourself and others. But the first step in that equation is I've got to prove to you that VR feels real.
Well, you proved that to me, and I was a non-believer, and I am totally a believer now. So how does that work for good? Because right now, I didn't get to do any of the other ones. That's not true. I actually danced with Grover and Elmo because they knew I was so afraid of the pit that they gave me a nice, friendly, fuzzy creature to interact with after that to help calm me down.
So in general, what we do is we build experiences. And what I like to say is imagine an experience that's made you better. What is that experience? Think about all the reasons you are who you are. These are a set of experiences. Maybe it's a trip that you took. Maybe it's a social interaction that you had. But people are a product of their experiences. And so my lab, what we do is we build very rare, intense experiences that make you rethink who you are. For example, in 2003, when I arrived at Stanford, one of the first things we built was the virtual mirror. And the virtual mirror, you walk up to a mirror and you move around in front of it and you see a reflection just like as if it were a real mirror. And what we do is after a certain amount of time where you really feel like that's you in the mirror, we hit a button and we change you. You go from white to black. You go from young to old. You go from male to female. You actually walk a mile in someone else's shoes. So that experience that you just had about the pit opening up and your heart rate increasing, when a man changes to a woman and then turns around and there's another person in VR with you, and that man who's with you when you're now wearing a female body proceeds to physically assault you or to say horrible things about your gender, when you experience this harassment in the body of someone else, it's just as powerful as the experience you had, but you learn a really intense life lesson.
Wow.
So here's a great study that I like, and so I always like to ask Denise the outcomes of a study. Jeremy, correct me if I got this wrong. In one condition, you go into VR and they have you in a redwood forest with these towering trees and you cut it down. You cut down a tree. And then in the other one, they just ask you – they don't put you in VR. They ask you to imagine cutting down a redwood tree. And the hope is cutting down the tree in VR is going to be such a visceral experience that it'll make you want to conserve nature more. So the question – is how did they measure whether it had an effect?
Well, let me just correct your science a little bit before
yes,
I get to that.
I am so glad you're correcting him because he likes to stump me, and I love it when Dan is wrong. So go for it.
So there's three conditions, and this is a number of studies. In one condition, you actually enter VR. You have a haptic device. That's a word for a virtual touch. It shakes your hands like a chainsaw. And in virtual reality, you cut down these two big trees. When the tree lands, the floor shakes and booms your knees. Really intense. Feels like you're cutting down a tree. In condition two, you watch a video shot from the shoulder of a lumberjack, and you see what it would be look like in a movie to cut down a tree. And in condition three, you read a beautifully written narrative of what it would be like to cut down a tree. So we're comparing doing it to watching it to reading about it.
Very nice. Okay. Very nice.
Thank
very
you.
Nice.
All right. So your question to me is?
So they've done this, and they think this may lead to some behavior change. You may want to conserve trees more. So how do they measure whether it was successful? Which condition was the most successful?
Well, you don't just do this on lumberjacks who cut down trees. So they have to look at your behavior post-VR.
Right.
So they ask you about your conservation experiences, like did you recycle yesterday?
Yeah, so people do things like that where they'll give you some choices of charities to give to, and they'll see, do you give to the conservation charity? But in this study, Jeremy?
So we did two things. We did ask pre and post, before and after this experience, if you're going to conserve more paper. And it turns out that everybody who reads about deforestation before coming into this experience, it doesn't matter what condition you are in, everyone says they're going to use less paper.
Yeah, they say it.
But with conservation, talk is cheap. Everyone who's listening right now, we all want to do more. We all want to change our driving behavior, sort our recyclables better. It's hard to do it. So what we did was we actually tracked paper use after the study. We had we've actually done this a few different ways. This study is now replicated in a few different ways. But the first time we did it, Sunju An, who was the PhD student running the study, she was visibly pregnant at the time. And why this is important is that what she did is she knocked over a glass of water on a table after the study was over. It was about a half an hour later. And there was a stack of napkins on the table. Grace would point to her belly and say, you know, I'm pregnant. Can you please clean that up for me? And everybody helped clean up. And what we did is we counted to see how many napkins they used when cleaning up the spill. When you cut down the virtual reality tree compared to the other two conditions, you use 20% less paper. So now,
wow.
In all three conditions, everyone says they're going to recycle, but the ones who actually cut down the tree in VR, who have this experience, they change this entrenched, really hard to change behavior.
So first of all, next time I want the tree cutting thing instead of the leaping over the pit and almost dying thing. I'm just saying for next time.
No, you might be traumatized for cutting down a beautiful redwood tree as well.
That is true. I maybe froze. And I will say this, when you said it feels like a chainsaw, I was surprised because I got to hold those little hand things. I was surprised how much you really do feel. I think the sound and the floor kind of feels like it's moving. It's all a part of it, right? So it definitely – you need that stuff. It's not – I just don't want people to think you're watching one of those 360-degree movies like at the theme parks or something. This is – you're definitely feeling like you're all in.
You know, one of the things we do in the lab is we study – what parts of the technology make the experience special? So what leads to presence? And what is important is body movement. So you can't walk around a spherical video, a 360 video. What makes VR special is being able to move your body, take a step forward, and the scene updates, or reach your hand out and touch an object and feel some vibration, or to be able to grab something and move it. It's really about what we call these – they're called interactives as opposed to watching a 360 video. It's learning by doing.
So let me ask in a slightly different direction. This is very compelling. I can experience the world. Are you worried that everybody's just going to end up being in armchairs, fat, drinking beer, experience the world through virtual reality?
You know, I do worry about addiction. So despite running a VR lab, I'm not a VR enthusiast for the world. I think VR is a very special thing. It should be used for intense experiences you couldn't have otherwise. It's my hope that people use this for transformative, really special experiences. And the problem is that what do we know about media now? You know, at Stanford, it seems like our students, they can't walk unless their thumbs are moving. They can only walk while texting, right? So what's the world going to look like when social networking feels like the best party you've ever been to, when online gambling feels like Las Vegas, and when pornography feels like sex? How is the world going to function?
You are listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. And in case you're wondering, we are speaking with Jeremy Baylinson, director of Stanford University's Virtual Human Interaction Lab, talking about really feeling like you're immersed somewhere and how it's being used in the world.
So if I can take a turn, we are called Schools In, not virtual sex. So I thought maybe we'll bring it back a little bit. So what are some of the educational applications of this? So one seems to me behavior change, that it causes you to not use as much paper. What are some other things?
You know, for me, the home run for education, there's, you know, when you think about what Stanford has done in the past, we think of these things we call MOOCs, massive online open courses. And this is, in my opinion, kind of a fancy name for a videotape of a professor, which technology we've had for a long time. I don't want to replace the classroom with virtual reality. What I want to do is build field trips. These are 5-minute, maybe 10-minute experiences that take you to a place that you couldn't go otherwise. And, you know, if you think of your notion of a field trip growing up, you get to go to the nation's capital, you get to go to a factory and see how something's built. These are special things. And what I want to do is build field trips that are designed to augment teaching, not to replace it.
So you had one study that was basically insane. You were like, kids were going scuba diving. But then they were also doing a coral reef in virtual reality.
So this is an example of – imagine that you went to a very wealthy high school and you actually got to go scuba diving and learn marine science that way. Turns out there are a couple schools that get to do that. What we did is we built a 7-minute journey where you got to go to the Mediterranean, actually swim around a reef and do a species count, pick up shells of snails and look at them and basically understand how the ecosystem works given various levels of what's called ocean acidification. It's a 7-minute science lesson, and we put it in high school classes. We put it at film festivals for adults to learn informally. We put it in college classes and compared the learning from that to control conditions, for example, reading about it, watching a movie. And, you know, we could talk a lot about the findings, but the most important finding in my mind is just how fun it is. I mean, getting to go and swim around, it's a neat way to learn.
But it's not just any experience, because it's an experience where you can actually make sure that people bump into the experience you want.
Well, I was going to say, because I actually saw the movie. So part of – after I did the pit and almost died, they had someone else.
Denise, let it go.
I'm still shaking from it. They show – so another woman who was on the tour with me put the headset on and they showed that movie.
Yep.
And first of all, it's beautiful. It's you know, I was watching the movie. I wasn't feeling anything. I was watching the movie.
Yeah.
And you could see probably like a lot of kids in school could watch a movie about that.
Yep.
And it was nowhere near as impactful as what the woman was experiencing. And we were seeing what she was experiencing because I saw her turn her head and I could see what she was seeing. And she was clearly more interactive and into it than me, who was just sort of watching this movie.
Right. She's like ducking.
Yeah. You know, she's – yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, Dan and I have collaborated before. One of the things we've studied is what's called embodied cognition. And this is – we know that obviously the mind is in the brain, but it turns out body movements change learning as well. And being able to walk around, grab things, you know, experiment and to use your hands, it really helps.
So this stuff's very powerful. I mean, it's still kind of amazing to me that it captures you. All my cognition says it is not this thing. And it doesn't matter. I'm completely captured. Turns out it has a strong residue as I go forward. So these things will become commercialized. Now I'm going to be playing my first-person shooter games in virtual reality with a headset on. Are we worried about the residue of those kinds of things now that the experience has become more and more compelling? I may develop sort of bad directions in my behavior change.
Well, with first-person shooters, there's two concerns. The first is the desensitization argument. And, you know, Brad Bushman at the Ohio State University has run some studies showing that, you know, when it's in VR, it's a little more desensitizing than compared mm-hmm. to a 2D video game. But the bigger concern from my mind is training. So I do a lot of work with the military, and for 30 years, we have used VR to train soldiers. The problem with immersive VR with these games, you're not just changing motivation, but you're actually teaching the skills and the muscle memory to carry out violence. So that's the challenge there.
We will have more with Jeremy Baylinson coming up. You are listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're on the campus of Stanford University and on Sirius XM Insight 121. We translate the research we know about best practices with school, curriculum, and parenting to teachers, administrators, parents, and youth.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope from the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In. I'm Denise here with Dan, and our guest today is Jeremy Baylinson, director of Stanford University's Virtual Human Interaction Lab. And Jeremy, in addition to the pit, I had a lovely experience in your lab where I got to pretend to dance with Grover and Elmo from Sesame Street. And you have done some studies about Sesame Street. So tell us about those.
So in the history of virtual reality research, there's been about 30 studies that have looked at anyone under the age of 18. When you look at young kids, for example, 6 and 5-year-olds, there's only been 3 studies ever done. One of them has come out of my lab. It turns out when parents ask me the question, is it okay for my 5-year-old to use VR, we just don't have an answer. And so Jackie Bailey, a PhD student in my lab, she ran a large study, 60 children, 30 in each condition. Half the children saw immersive VR and half of them saw TV, and they got to meet Grover. And what she was measuring was something called executive function.
They got to meet Grover in virtual reality.
I got to dance, wow. By the way, with him, just to say. Very cool.
A side note, we brought the CEO of Sesame, who was previously the CEO of Nickelodeon, and he came in a VR skeptic, and he said, I don't want to come to the lab. And he put on the helmet, and he got to meet Grover and Elmo in VR. And when he took that helmet off, he said, those guys are more realistic than the Muppets on my set.
Wow.
He felt like they were. They're really very present.
Yeah.
Well, they're also big. I know that sounds weird, but you see them small and then the guy pushed a button and they grew. Right. And that had an immediate effect on me.
Did you start crying?
No, I didn't. I actually, you know, this is going to sound crazy from the pit experience, but I actually wanted to hug. I'm not making that up. There's this feeling, you get this feeling because there's this really cute, fuzzy, free person, yeah. Person, thing, whatever, Muppet. But you have this desire to, hug or interact. I actually tried to shake hands. You know, it's because it's right there.
So what happened to the kids?
Well, one of the things that we're looking at, let's just talk about adults for a second, is Elmo asks you to dance. He says, get out of your chair and dance with us. And it's funny when we give demos to high, you know, these very VIPs that come to the lab, and, you know.
Suits.
You know, John Hennessy, the president of Stanford, just started dancing with Elmo.
You can't say no. I was dancing.
You know, we have high up military folks that just come in and start dancing. It's fun. So one thing we're looking at the children is imitation and compliance. So when somebody asks you to do something, are they more likely to? And we're still in the process of analyzing this data. But what it's looking like thus far is massive changes in how influential these characters are in virtual reality compared to seeing them in a two-dimensional space.
So in the end, the business school is going to get hold of this to figure out how to get car salesmen to sell cars better.
Well, one of the reasons we're working with Sesame is that Sesame for quite some time has been producing pro-social content. So we're working with them to build a couple scenarios to, you know, can Grover teach you empathy in VR differently than he would on television, and trying to at least begin to think about what those, you know, affordances of the technology that can produce empathy for these kids.
So let's talk about the classroom. So there's always these pictures of like the 1940s, I think, of a movie audience with their 3D glasses on. So is this what it's going to be? I'm going to have my class of 30 kids and they're all going to be wearing VR helmets, experiencing things. And as the teacher, I'll be manipulating what shows up in their scene. Is this the end game?
You know, we're still figuring out what works and what doesn't in the classroom. Dan, you and I co-advised Brian Prohn's dissertation.
Right.
And one of the things he discovered is that a high school student, when he goes into VR, you know, his buddies are kind of making fun of him and taking pictures of him. It turns out, you know, I like to say that VR, it's kind of like holding a little infant in your arms. It's really hard to look cool when you're cooing at a baby and you can't not coo. And VR is the same way. You just don't look cool. And so one thing we learned in this study was that you've got to be careful, especially at that age, with, you know, what are the other kids doing when their buddies in VR?
So I see these ads. You know, they show the ads for the VR, like the Galaxy VR. And they always show someone having a great time and the people around them are sort of – it's as though they think they can see what that person's seeing. They're so happy for them, but there's no chance they know what this person is seeing, and they're probably all laughing at them.
Those are good commercials.
All right. You're listening to School's In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are speaking with Jeremy Bailenson about VR, virtual reality. Jeremy, talk to us about a football study or football use for VR.
Yeah, so Derek Belch, he took my virtual people class in 2005. Derek was the field goal kicker for the Stanford team at the time when we were 42-point underdogs against USC. He's the one that kicked the extra point to win the game. So that's his.
Yay! Woohoo!
We just lost the LA market. That's fine.
So Derek took my class in 2005. He came up after class. So, Jeremy, can we use VR to train athletes? And I said, Derek, that's a great idea, but the tech is not ready yet. Come back in a decade. And he did. In 2014, he came to my lab to do his master's thesis while he was an assistant coach on the Stanford team. And his thesis was using spherical video. It's a kind of VR that's a video that you can look around by moving your head to produce training simulations for the quarterbacks. And what we're training is not how to kick or throw, but how to quickly look around a scene recognize a pattern, and make a decision. So for quarterbacks, what that means is you've got to look around, recognize the defense, and based on what the defense is doing, decide if you're going to keep the play you had or change to a new play. So Coach Shaw allowed us to have 5 minutes of practice on Monday. We would bring out this really heavy rig at the time. It was hard to capture video in 360 back then. And we'd have the defense pretend they were the team we were playing on Saturday and throw out about 10 plays that we were likely to see on Saturday. Then I'd go back to the lab and we would build these VR scenes, and by Wednesday we'd bring them back to the football office, and then the quarterbacks and some of the other players would basically take mental repetitions and they'd relive these plays over and over again and figure out what they would do in that situation.
So this is interesting. You know, in World War I, one of the big breakthroughs was flight simulators.
Yeah.
They would put people in barrels and rotate the barrels around. This had a huge effect. Yeah. It sort of helped us fight the Red Baron.
In 1929, Ed Link makes the first flight simulator. Huh. Why does he do it? Because you should learn by doing.
Yeah.
You should learn by making mistakes when the costs are low. Planes are expensive. Lives are even more expensive, hence the flight simulator.
Yeah.
And the same message applies to football. Let's give us endless repetitions where we can practice. And when you make a wrong decision, it's not like you have to have all these players on the field or you could possibly get hurt. It's a nice way to get mental repetitions on demand.
So I like look to my right and I see a linebacker, and then I look to my left and I see some defensive lineman rushing me.
Yeah.
And it's coming at me, and so I have to decide whether to get the ball.
Quarterbacks
out.
Make decisions about what play to run pre-snap, before the ball is snapped, when they're at the line of scrimmage. They have about a second and a half, and they make these decisions based on a subtle shift in posture from one player. And by giving them endless repetitions, they get to hone their skills. And after 3 weeks, Coach Shaw made it mandatory for the players.
No kidding.
Kevin Hogan, who was our quarterback at the time, will be the first to tell you that he believes that he had the best 4 games of his career after using it, and it goes on.
Okay, so I am a diehard Stanford football fan, and I think we owe you a huge debt of gratitude. You are the reason why we won the Rose Bowls. I know those 4 games that you're talking about with Hogan.
So Derek would be really careful to never claim credit for Kevin's brilliance. Okay, we gave him one more tool that helped, and we, you know, of the 100 tools that Stanford uses to be great, we gave them one little extra one.
Well, thank you, because that is awesome.
We like it's fun. It's fun to work with the team.
Dan, we're going to say goodbye to our guest and thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy. That was amazing.
Thanks, guys.
I had an amazing time at your lab, and I am still shaking from it. But I have to say, I wasn't a believer. I really was someone who kind of a skeptical coming in, and you definitely made me a believer.
I'm so glad.
So the story with VR, this immersive VR, is that our imagination isn't up to it yet. So like all the things that Jeremy described, I would have never thought of doing that, of having me turn around and I see myself as a 60-year-old African-American woman, or cutting down a redwood tree to change my attitudes towards nature, or being the quarterback, having people rushing at me. So I kind of agree with him, is that this is something new that we got to learn about, learn how to use it for education, learn its side effects. You know, does it have some bad things? But the amazing thing is just my imagination is not up to thinking about what you could do with this technology because it's so new.
I love it, and I'm afraid, but I'm excited for what can happen. I used to teach To Kill a Mockingbird to have people learn how to walk in someone else's shoes, and now you can really do it. That's amazing.
Very good.
You're listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're on the campus of Stanford University and on Sirius XM Insight 121.